Well, a big warm welcome, fellow baseball nerds, to episode 12 of the Johnny and Josh Show. What a great pleasure to have you company. My name's Johnny Gould, and as always, thrilled to be invited by my baseball brothers, the legends that are JC, Big Dave Bengal, and Eric, the producer. Boys, lovely to have you company.
Gouldie, big rugby weekend for you.
Big rugby weekend, but more significant than that, Spinal Tap update. Have I watched it? No. Move on. New business. Thank you. Bath the rugby. Thank you for mentioning it, JC. Jessica,
He needs a special moment,
David. Exactly. Yeah. The boys, blue, black and white. It's not been a great season, lads, but we finished on a high with a cracking win in a very thrilling game. So, and the fact was there was 3,500 of us in the stadium. Guys, it's only the second time in 15 months. It was amazing. Move on swiftly. Episode 12. Now you're going to be
episode 12, which is one more than Spinal Tap, isn't it?
That's right. One more than 11, which is Spinal Tap, which I still haven't watched. Number 12, and this is interesting, particularly with regards to Spinal Tap, strongly associated with the heavens. We've got 12 months. We've got 12 signs of the zodiac. We've got 12 stations of the moon and the sun. It's significant in ancient Greece as well. The Greeks worshipped 12 major gods of Olympus. And despite all of that biblical and divine intervention, I still haven't watched Spinal Tap. But what a great joy to have
the boys. But I feel blessed to be here.
I bet you do. Talking about notable 12s, anybody want to throw a few notable 12 baseball players out?
God.
Baseball world, one comes to mind. Wade Boggs.
Yeah, handy in his game.
Ernie Banks.
More than handy. I always thought of him as sort of the American League analog to Tony Gwynn, you know, guy who just had really great bat control. He did something that Gwynn did too in his career, where one season he decided, okay, I'm going to hit home runs. And he lost about 10 points on his average and hit like double the home runs. And I know Gwynn could do that too. It was just amazing. These guys were so talented and so much ahead of the pitchers of their era.
Wade Boggs is one of those stories. He has a beer story. Like where he drank how many beers on his way to Seattle?
And then on a plane, like there was a Wade Boggs challenge, isn't it? Like, how many beers can you drink in one sitting? And my advice is, kids, don't drink.
His whole thing though was the chicken man. He had to have the chicken before the chicken. Game.
That's right. It was lemon chicken, wasn't it? Before at his dressing room, he has to eat lemon chicken pregame. That was his pregame.
Love he had a dressing room. It was like he was, a member of Spinal Tap, and
Hey guys, funny you should bring up on the Wade Boggs and the chicken side, because I did an article only this week on great sporting superstitions focusing on baseball. And did you know that his wife, because of his chicken obsession, had 62 different chicken recipes so things wouldn't get boring and repetitive? How about that for a bit of stats?
Not bad. Who else is number 12? Dusty Baker. Dusty Baker wore number 12.
Johnny B. Baker.
Love it. Okay. Here's some good triv. Moving out of baseball, who's the most famous number 12 in another sport?
Tom Brady.
Well done, Big Dave.
Actually, there was a baseball connection. I'll say it again. He was a Montreal Expo at the spring training. So there is a baseball lateral connection.
Okay. Well, let's move on from notable 12s. Let's focus on COVID update. Is there one? I don't think we've had any problems, have we? Canadian border, Eric, still closed?
Canadian border is actually still closed, but with an asterisk, because allow me to put some NHL ice hockey in here. The Montreal Canadiens are the last team to be to have won out of the North Division in this newly realigned COVID National Hockey League. They will be given special dispensation by the Canadian government to fly to Las Vegas and cross the Canadian border, and the Vegas Golden Knights will be able to enter Canada in a bubble. And play.
That's a big step.
It is a big step. So
how can they do that and not allow the Jays in?
Because at least it's just a best of seven series, entire season.
Yeah, right. But there'd be two, right, if they make it to the Stanley Cup Finals.
That's true. Then it would be either the Tampa Bay Lightning or the New York Islanders who would go to Montreal should Montreal make it the final.
And I got to say, Eric, we upped Bath on behalf of Johnny Gould. We should up the Canadians from your hometown, Montreal.
Absolutely.
That's right. Thank you
what
very much.
Run. Yes.
We're going for our 25th Stanley Cup. Thank you very much. It's been a while.
A lot
since
of late
1993.
Nights for Eric Jansen.
Yes, right? Exactly. The thing about it as well, speaking of the Blue Jays, they're committed to Salem Field in Buffalo till July 21st. And then they go on the road again. Then they'll come back. It looks like they'll come back to Salem Field to Buffalo, because the Canadian border is still closed for the Blue Jays. But the Blue Jays have announced that, it's not impossible, maybe late August, back in the city of Toronto. But, let's not count our chickens just yet.
Guys, this is that point of the program where we get everybody pointy piano playing down the bottom because we want people to subscribe, we want them to click. And I'll tell you why this is relevant, because I've just been checking out our Twitter feed, the at Johnny and Josh show. We've got 1,955 followers as of today, as of record. And I'm offering a Johnny G prize to our 2,000th Twitter follower. So we need everybody.
Don't do it that way, Goldie. Say anyone who is in the 2,000 can get it. Otherwise, then you're just trying to game it to be number 2,000. So
if you're
one of the 2,000, there's ways to pick one of those people. So.
Okay, that's a good point. And then everybody can be a winner, because that's what we're all about. We want everybody to be a winner, even when you're a loser.
What are you going to give them, Goldie?
I'm going to come up with a Johnny Jeep goodie bag. I've got loads of stuff from the days of
our baseball card.
Before we go on as well, we also make another announcement. We're going to be taking a little brief hiatus, potentially, because yours truly has to step away for a while, because I've got a lot of other commitments. I've got Wimbledon coming up. I've got the Olympics coming up. So the Johnny and Josh show shall still continue, but the important pieces will still be there.
The most important piece will be lost.
Exactly. It'll just be like running the race without the baton.
You guys Absolutely. Will be fine without me for a while.
Who's going to not pick Josh's books to review it?
Exactly. Who's going to leave? Can you leave the trivia questions at the door on your way out?
Joshua books. Now the thing is, I shall be taking a brief step away from the show because I have loads of other commitments. But I'm sure I'll be seeing you all again later on in the baseball season. I'll come in as a guest.
You got some fun stuff coming up though. You got Wimbledon. You got the Olympics. You're kind of big league. You're big league in us.
I'm a busy man, but I'll miss you guys, but I'll be back one day.
This is the last show from you for a while, so why don't we get our trivia question, and I'm hoping you're going to make it a special.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because as youthful and exuberant as we all are, I figure we're talking about Vlad Guerrero Jr., a player of fine Canadian stock, might I add, born in Montreal. He actually, this week hit his 19th home run.
Yep.
And he recently become the age of 22. Not bad for somebody at 22 years old, leading the league in home runs. But my question to you is, which of these players actually hit the most home runs before the age of 22? Career home runs. Okay. Was it A, A-Rod? Was it B, Mike Trout? Or was it C, Bryce Harper?
Ooh.
So which of those three players hit the most home runs before the age of 22? Okay. I'll tell you, it's not Vlad Guerrero Jr., but more on Vlad later on.
Right, moving on. Thank you for that, Eric. We'll get the answer to that trivia question from Josh, no doubt, in the seventh inning stretch. But let's focus on our leadoff batter for this show. And as we all know, we're 10 weeks into the MLB regular season. The weather is hotting up, and so does the news. Therefore, worthy of its leadoff hitter status. So here is the news roundup. Right, guys, quick update. Our first news item, crackdown on foreign substances update. We discussed it in some detail last week, but since last week's show, we've had the Gerrit Cole presser. I'm assuming you watched it. I found it really uncomfortable. I don't know how you boys felt, but it seemed pretty obvious. He wanted to admit that, we all do it. I've done it, but suddenly realized perhaps it wasn't something he should be saying. What's your thought?
And I wish he did, Goldie, because it was so clear that he has done it. I mean, at least it seemed in my mind. And what you do is you say, yes, I've done it. And it is something that is accepted within the, maybe not the rules, but the spirit of the law in baseball. And so I did it. And if the rules change and they start cracking down on it, then I will change. I just feel like if someone were to own it a little bit more, I mean, it's always part of the problem with these things is it's not the act, it's the cover up to a certain extent. And I realize it's kind of bold, but we saw this with steroids. I mean, it's Rafael Palmeiro going to in front of Congress and wagging his finger, that just adds to the pain of it all. Own it and say, look, this is the way it's been. I know it's not great, but people are so worried about their profile and their presentation that they're scared to say anything that would make them reflect poorly in the public eye.
Well, there's also the fact that the Yankees gave him a whole lot of money, and it's not a great look for him to come out and start admitting things after they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in him, potentially based on his, you know, his profile as a pitcher of being an ace. And maybe he's not an ace without, you know, without the gunk.
Guys, another sideline to all this. Paul Fry, relief pitcher for the Orioles, who pretty much has taken over as their closer. His latest outing, his speed is still the same, which you would expect, but his spin rate, apparently, is significantly down, making him significantly more hittable. And immediately you start to question, well, is that the result of the fact that at the moment, because there's such an eye on all this, that he's not able to use some gunk, some sticky substance, etc.? Now, the guy could be completely innocent, but you're immediately asking questions. Is it a coincidence? That surely now is a problem that we potentially might see pitchers who've been performing really well. Suddenly, they're not performing quite so well. And then you really have got a problem because it's abundantly clear this is a universal problem.
Yeah, but you can't make a determination off of one appearance after this discussion. And we saw that with Cole, right? He came off his first appearance right after all of this, and there was a suggestion that his spin rate was down. And then the game after that, he threw well. So, you know, spin rate is an interesting element. And I know that people are now equating it more than even velocity with success. I always thought of it as, it was interesting when I was a catcher. You'd have pitchers who wouldn't throw at the highest velocity, but their ball just felt heavier. And I would attribute that now that we've gotten to the analytics stage, as just having a greater spin rate. It just feels heavier. When you make contact off a pitcher who throws a heavier ball, you just don't make as good contact as sort of the slower spin rate. But, you know, I guess the question is at what point is a difference made? You know, we're talking thousands of revolutions per second or whatever the metric is. And so if it's down 100, all of a sudden, does it feel completely different? If it's down 10, is it completely different?
Yeah,
and I think that that's a huge part of it too, which is what is the differentiator in terms of how it's, you know, changing the way the ball spins.
Okay. And, but also, it's not just about spin. And this is kind of a question for Josh, really. Does the stick also allows you to kind of rear back and throw your fastball with greater command? Doesn't it give you more confidence that you can command a fastball like that? Just having
Yeah, I mean, grip makes a huge difference. You know, the spin makes it heavier. I think that that's a feel thing. So it would depend on the pitcher. I think certainly some pitchers would gain more confidence from him. But the issue becomes less about that, Dave, and more about what have you been doing over and over again and built your mechanics around. So right. If you built your mechanics around using spider tack and, you know, that's a part of your, you know, the way you throw, then yes, it's going to make a huge difference. If you're using it here and there in certain instances where the weather's different, maybe not as much.
Okay, well, from one great pitcher to another, guys, terrible news for Cardinal fans. Jack Flaherty, oblique strain, massive impact this is going to have on the NLC race. I mean, he himself, 8-1 so far this season, 290 ERA, 67 strikeouts before his injury. I think they were just one game out of first place, very competitive when he was healthy. I think they then went and lost five straight off the back of this. It's going to have a massive impact on the Cards' ability to make the postseason. And there's a question mark about when he's going to come back. They don't think it's going to be in a couple of weeks. It could be quite considerably longer.
Yeah, oblique injuries are terrible. They will really take a lot. The two things that are the worst, I mean, obviously, besides blowing out your elbow, are hamstrings and obliques. Those are the ones that really take a long time to heal. And it's really bad timing for the Cardinals, especially because not only are they struggling, but it comes at a time where the Cubs are really ascending. I mean, it's not just Chris Bryant. You know, their pitching staff has gotten really solid. Craig Kimbrell's back now. He's looking like the type of lights out closer he was in previous years. So I think it's going to put a lot of pressure on the Cards, no doubt. But I think that they were going to be in for it anyway with the Cubs and then the type of team they are. Dave Ross has proved to be quite a good manager. You know, that it's become so cliche, but you want a clubhouse where the players want to play for the manager. And as much as cliche, I think that's the case in Chicago right now on the north side.
And don't forget the Brewers are playing a lot better as well.
Yeah.
They've won, I think, like 7 out of their last 8. And going back even farther, they've had quite a run. So I wouldn't, you know, they were about 500 not so long ago, and now they're 9 over. So yeah, to Josh's point, it is a very difficult time for the Cardinals to sustain an injury like that in that division.
The Brewers, as you quite rightly mentioned, Dave, they're 8-2 for their last 10. They won the last two. They're now tied with the Cubs with a .571 record. So
and Yelich wasn't even hitting. And he, you know, maybe he's starting to come around a little.
Well, the Cards are now four back, guys. And I can only see it getting worse. Okay, let's focus on another big-time star. This is amazing stat. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Eric's already mentioned the fact that he leads the numbers in home runs with 19. Really young guy. He's obviously finally, you know, having the season everybody anticipated he would have. And yet, this stat came out this week, and I don't know if you've seen this. He earns 15, that's 15% of what an average Major League Baseball player earns. So he's on $605,400 this season. And yet you look at his numbers, whether it be leading the league in home runs, on base and slugging percentages, advanced measures like offensive wins above replacement, you know, his batting average, 335, 45 runs batted in. I mean, it's an extraordinary stat. 15% of the league average.
But Goldie, it's not surprising at all if you follow baseball, right? One of the issues of the way the baseball financial structure is set up is that players are paid for past performance. So you have the 6 years and you get to free agency, and then that resume, and particularly the year, your platform year going into free agency, that's where you make your money. And that structure is unlikely to change. But what we have seen, and what will probably happen with Vladimir Guerrero, and we saw it with Tatis Jr., is that teams try to lock up those players early. And I suspect that you're going to see in this offseason that the Blue Jays are going to do everything in their power to buy out some of the arbitration years that you have after, you know, your years where your contract is set, where teams have no responsibility to raise your salary regardless of performance. That leads to a lot of tension. But the buy out the arbitration years, maybe buy out the first year of free agency, he's going to get paid. And we're seeing teams trying to work around what the historical paid for past performance attitude is. So it's not, to me, it's not surprising if you follow baseball.
And I think this is one of the biggest issues going into the big labor negotiations that are coming up, is that, as we've seen in the post steroid era, that baseball isn't as much of an older person's game as it used to be, that younger players will be looking to get theirs a little bit sooner. So maybe they will be fighting hard to maybe lose a year or two out of that service time requirement before they become a free agent. I mean, that makes sense to me. And especially when you look at a guy like Vladimir Guerrero, who, by the way, is leading in every Triple Crown category right now. He's leading with 19 home runs, 50 RBIs, leading in batting average, on base, slugging, and OPS. He's leading in absolutely everything. Total bases. The guy is a monster. And he's not making enough.
And he lost weight as well.
Yeah, and to David's point, I talk about the historical financial model, but that is changing because teams recognize it. And we're seeing more and more younger players coming up earlier because they want to. I mean, you kind of want to time it right, right? They'll hold players back for service time, but when their time comes, they try and get players up earlier. And those big contracts on the back, fewer and fewer players get them. So the ownership has made the change, and David's right. The Players Association now needs to have a course correction on their part in order to make sure their players are getting the amount of money in their pockets that they want to get.
Okay, well, from a golden youngster to a golden oldie, how about this for a story, guys? The Padres have signed Joe Bemel, a relief pitcher, at the age of 44 to a minor league contract. I love it. It gives me hope. I could still be a major leaguer.
I love this story, Goldie. So Joe Bimel was playing in a game in, I think it was San Antonio, with Cody Decker, who was a really very colorful minor leaguer, had a brief stint in the major leagues. He goes out there as a lefty, he's throwing mid-90s. And all of a sudden, everyone's out there. It was a game to try and get Israel prepared for the Olympics. Israel earned one of the spots in the Olympic Games. And everyone was just shocked by it. And to Dave's point, we talk about older hitters don't age as well, but boy, the players who can keep their health are just shockingly good. I always think back to the story of Jim Morris, right? The guy who was a pitcher for the Rays, who hurt his arm and then was a high school coach, starts pitching BP. He's all of a sudden throwing 95, right? Ends up playing for the Rays. There was a movie with Dennis Quaid about his life. He was 35. Joe Bimel, who admittedly was a major leaguer, but Joe Bimel is 44. That's 9 years older. So, you know, we're seeing if you keep your health, you can actually extend your career. Like Jacob DeGrom's talking about throwing into his 40s now. And that's potentially something doable.
You mentioned Jacob DeGrom as well. I mean, Dave, you got to love what this guy's doing. He's conceded less runs than he's actually hit as a National League pitcher. you know, as I'm having to bat in the bottom of the order. He's conceded just four runs all season. He's got a 0.56 ERA. He's now talking about, as Josh Smith mentioned, pitching into his 40s. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything this guy can't do. And yet there is a cloud.
There is a little, well, first of all, I want to start off with this, which is last night, you could not take your eye off a frame of that game last night. It was just fantastic to watch. First of all, you had over 30,000 people in Queens last night. That's the biggest crowd in 2 years that they had for a Major League Baseball game in that park. And so the atmosphere was just electric, and DeGrom was electric. And obviously he does it, you know, he's like a kind of mini Ohtani all of a sudden. You know, maybe they're going to have to start putting him out in the outfield after his, you know, keep him in the lineup. but you know, the only, I'm not about to accuse DeGrom of anything. All I have to say is, like, sometimes baseball stats just don't make sense. Like, it didn't make sense when Barry Bonds hit 50% more home runs than he'd ever hit before, ever in his entire career at a late age. And it's, there's just such a small sample of pitchers who have performed on this level. I believe there was one pitcher who had an ERA after 10 starts, even remotely close to DeGrom. And it just makes you wonder, like, because the stats, they're just not normal baseball stats. And I know that there's other things going on in the game that are affecting this. And we've seen ERAs across the board go down. Like, I don't actually believe that Marcus Stroman is like a mid 2.5 ERA pitcher. Like, I don't believe that. And I think that you could say that for a lot of pitchers in Major League Baseball right now. They're not as good, you know, they're better than they should be. And so that goes all the way down the line. And it just makes you wonder when you see baseball stats you're accustomed to growing up, and then they don't make sense.
It goes both ways, though, David. It's not just the pitcher, it's the hitters as well, too. And I was watching that game between the Padres and the Mets, and watching Will Myers on a slider outside miss the pitch by feet. You know, there is so little plate discipline now by so many hitters that they are just guessing, but it's hard. You know, you look at DeGrom, and I think he's thrown, as a starter, pitches over 100 miles an hour. He's like 10 times or 8 times, whatever the number was, more times he's thrown that than the next pitcher to have thrown 100 miles per hour plus as a starter. He is a dominant pitcher in a way that we haven't seen comparative to the rest of the field, really, in the last many decades. And that's the thing about him, is that he really is special, that he can really sit on that fastball, but live by the sword and die by the sword. And I think this is going to be the issue with DeGrom. And we're seeing this with the injuries that he is continually getting. I know he has great mechanics. I know he looks smooth on the mound, but the type of torque required to throw at that type of speed will catch up to you. And if DeGrom,
already catching up,
right. It's already catching up, but it could be even worse, right? You know, bye-bye UCL, bye-bye labrum, whatever it is. And I think that if he is going to be the pitcher he wants to be and continue his career into his 40s, it's going to require a reset at some point, a reformulation, in the way that we saw with like a Justin Verlander, even the likes of Nolan Ryan, these great power pitchers. As they get later in their career, they're going to have to figure out something else. And DeGrom, more than any of those guys, relies so much on the fastball. He's throwing it like over 60%.
I don't think he relies on it. I think it's his choice. I think that he can make that adjustment anytime he wants. He has a changeup that he never uses. He has a curve he never uses. He's just going with it because they can't hit it. That's why he keeps going with it.
I think the quality, I like his curveball. His slider is really set up by the fastball. I don't think the slider would be as good if he didn't throw 100 miles an hour. I think people would lay off, to the point on the at-bat that I was talking about with Will Myers. He missed it by so much because he's looking fastball. It looks like the rotation of fastball and then cuts out of the zone tremendously. So, I'm not saying he isn't going to be a good pitcher if all of a sudden he's throwing an average of 94 miles an hour. Is he going to be one of the greatest of all time at that point? Maybe not. Maybe he's going to be no longer an ace for rotation. So he is going to have to reformulate and rejigger, and that all pitchers have to do that over the course.
It's going to be a lot of fun watching him try to figure it out, though, because he's just such an so
and to be honest, that's a few years away anyway. Right now, just enjoy the ride of a guy who can throw 100 miles an hour 10 times in a game as a starter. It's crazy.
Okay, boys, thank you for that. Let's move on to the worst team in Major League Baseball. And I'm actually glad that we are getting them getting some reference, because if you are an Arizona D-backs fan, there's not a lot to be happy about. 1-9 in their last 10, lost their last 8 games. They've got the worst record in the whole of the major leagues. And it just gets worse. And not surprising, the news is out. They've sacked their hitting coach, Darnell Coles, their assistant hitting coach, Eric Hinks, never nice. Both been sacked on Thursday. No surprise. They're really struggling to score runs. I think 268 is the runs they've scored. I think only Pittsburgh have scored less. And really sad as well, as if they haven't got enough problems, the GM, Mike Hazen, has taken a leave of absence as his wife battles brain cancer. And obviously that's just terribly sad news. And we wish him and his wife and the family all the very best and a speedy recovery in her health. That's obviously the right decision. Tough times, guys, to be a D-backs fan.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated when teams don't fire the manager and they fire coaches, particularly hitting coaches in the middle of the season. Hitting's all about small adjustments, right? But in the middle of the season, it's hard to do too much. You're not going to break down your swing and start over again. So I don't know what their expectation is and how that's going to be difference making. I wonder if it's just we need to appear that we're doing something because we realize things are bad.
Yeah. I need to clarify. I've just made a statement that is wrong. They've scored so far this season 268 runs. And I could tell you straight away, because I'm looking at it, Pittsburgh significantly less, 217. St. Louis, the same amount. Milwaukee, less than them. Washington, less than them. Miami, less than them. Who else? New York Mets, okay, they've played less games. Philadelphia, less than them. Texas. So actually, the runs scored isn't really the problem. They've right. scored more than plenty. It's the runs conceded. So why are you sacking the hitting coaches?
That's a good question. They are a middle of the road offensive team, and they have some nice players that I think that are going to be very attractive to some teams that are competing to make the playoffs in a few weeks time. And as Arizona tries to kind of back up the truck and rebuild this thing, which they desperately need to do. But yeah, their pitching is a wreck. I mean, they have Madison Bumgarner, who's now hurt, who, you know, he threw that 7-inning no hitter. And, you know, just about since then has been a total disaster. And there's not much going on in the rotation. They're really hurt. They have four members of the rotation are on the DL right now. So look for them to trade the farm and kick restart this thing.
Well, and it doesn't help that you're in a division with the Giants, the Padres, and the Dodgers, right? No. I mean, I know the Rockies can, you know, give you a little something to sink your teeth into, but when you have three teams that are three of the best in the National League and you have to play so many interdivisional games, that's going to hurt you too.
Yeah. 100%. Right, let's finish off the news roundup with a quick update on our Badu watch. A view to Akil. Eric, how's our dear friend getting on this week?
He's still surviving in Detroit, and since we last recorded our last show, he went 5-for-16, 2 stolen bases, 2 runs. He's above the Mendoza line. He's batting at .250. Which, yeah, come on, you know, he's still not in Toledo. Yes. He's still okay. He'll still be there.
Yeah, and I wouldn't sandbag that. That's pretty solid in today's Major League Baseball.
Got an .830 OPS.
I think what's helped him is that he's now properly platooning. They brought up Daz Cameron, who was one of their big, phenoms off the farm. And it looks like they'll probably do a platoon there, which will allow him to sort of be in the best position to be the best version of Akil. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, the only thing the Tigers can hope for right now is finishing 500. You know, that's their target, you know, finishing maybe one game above 500. But I think we can write them off for wild card at this juncture. And speaking of which, last week, we've already elapsed 56 games for most teams in this past week in Major League Baseball, which would have meant that had this been last year, it would have been the end of the regular season. Right.
Wow, yeah.
So which means that had the season ended a few days ago, we'd had Tampa Bay, Yankees, Red Sox, Astros, Oakland, Cleveland, White Sox, and Toronto in the American League playoffs. And in the NLCS, you would have had the Giants, Cardinals, Padres, Cubs, Mets, Braves, Brewers, and Dodgers fighting it out for supremacy.
The Braves even at 29-32? What a mess they are. What's going on?
What
there?
A mess that division is. So this goes to show with roughly about 100 to 95 games left in the season, there's still a lot to play for. Moving on.
Okay, guys, well, our second batter up in the circle is the issue of youth in baseball. Is there too much expectancy I'm thinking Keston Hiura. Obviously, everybody had great anticipation with the Milwaukee Brewers, second baseman. I think he played mainly first base, though, this season. He was sent down. They brought him back up. They sent him down. Jared Kelenic came in with all this big hoo-ha. It's fantastic. I mean, almost the number one prospect in the organization, yet not performing. The question I want to ask, is too much pressure being put on the kids in baseball now? Because my perception is that in previous seasons, in previous ages, they didn't tend to come up to the majors at a very tender age, or very rarely. It was much more around the sort of 23, 24, the minor leagues would really sort of, you know, educate them, harden them. And we've had success with youngsters like Acuna and Tatis, that perhaps we've got a bit carried away. Perhaps baseball's got carried away. And now they're bringing up kids too early and they're suffering as a result. What's your thoughts on this, JC?
Yeah, I'm not feeling that, Goldie. I think back to 1951, Willie Mays comes up, you know, a lot of hoopla. He hits 139 through his first 10 games. And what Leo DeRocher, his manager, did there said, I'm going to keep on putting you out there. I'm going to trust in the fact that you're going to get there. I wonder whether the question's the other way around, which is we hit the panic button too quickly instead of letting players play it out a little bit. And they're putting increasing pressure on themselves as well. I think if there's anything that creates pressure nowadays, if I were a Major League Baseball player, I would get off of Twitter. I would get off of totally. Instagram. I would get off of Facebook. I would not look at any of that stuff. It gets a little bit more personal. And I think that would be the one issue that would be different and maybe impacting players. But overall, I think there's a long history of guys coming up, scuffling, and then ending up having great careers. I mean,
Trout.
In that season, Trout. In that season with Mays, you know, he ended up having a fine year, even though he started at 139 through his first 10 games. But his second year, before he went off to military service, he hit in the 230s before he finally had the career that we all know that he was going to have. So I wouldn't give up on players. I'd let them play it out a little bit more. But if I were a player, you got to really put on the earmuffs.
So, Dave, are we saying here that there aren't enough Frank Lampards in the world of baseball that are giving the kids a chance?
What does that mean?
Giving them a chance to
play. I don't
play.
Speak Frank Lampard.
Well, when he was manager of Chelsea, he brought in a load of academy kids. He sort of had to because of the transfer ban at the time. But he gave these kids, he gave them self-belief. He said, look, it doesn't matter what happens early on. You're going to get a proper chance to prove yourself. And as a result, you've had huge success from the sort of Mason Mounts, the Tammy Abrahams, etc. Is that what baseball managers need to be more like? What JC is saying, that managers need to take responsibility here and inflict confidence into these kids that it doesn't matter how bad it goes for the next 2-3 weeks. You're still part of our plans. You're going to be here.
Baseball just remains, you know, there's so many different variables to play into this. Like Josh likes to talk about baseball as a game of late bloomers. And, you know, some people get it a little bit earlier. You know, Keith Hernandez was terrible in his first, 64 games, 80 games. He wasn't very good at all. It just happens. And what hasn't helped is the fact that there hasn't been kind of like viable minor leagues for like the year and a half. These kids, some of these kids who have been prospects, just been kind of sitting around at the alternate site playing simulated games. And that's not a way to get your development going at all. So in a way, it's kind of not fair to a guy like Kelenic, who did lobby for his promotion and made a big fuss about not going up and with the Mariners trying to keep his service time down so that they could hold on to him for an extra season. But the guy didn't have anywhere to play for a year and a half. He didn't have anywhere to really hit properly. And I think at least in this time, I think that some young kids have really been hurt by that.
Moving forward, therefore, do we think that there is as much an influence of circumstance, i.e. the COVID-shortened season, the impact on the minor leagues, et cetera, that that's just as big a deal? And it's seasonal. These things happen. Therefore, there isn't an issue to be discussed here.
I think it's cyclical. I mean, I think every player really is different in baseball. Like, right. People hit at different times. Some people never hit.
And hey, yeah, look at Caleb Badu, case in point. You know, he's still there.
But I'm talking about like the big prospects, and I think of like Ke'Bryan Hayes last year, who came up and he had gangbusters and has continued to do so. Some players just get it right away. Yeah. Other players, it takes a while to get to that level, even if you have all the skill in the world.
And JC, is there a difference between hitters and pitchers? Does it take longer for a hitter or a pitcher, or is there no difference?
I mean, I think the factors that go into each of them are very different. That's, I mean, because I think if you have just raw skill as a pitcher, you can probably get by a little bit more. And there are ways to hide pitchers a little bit. You know, you bring them up and you start them in the bullpen.
Yeah.
You give them non-high leverage situations. As a hitter, in my mind, every situation's high leverage when you get that opportunity because, you know, you are there standing alone and, you know, every at bat can really impact you. Whereas pitchers, you know, the expectation is you're going to get a lot more guys out than are going to get hits off of you. So, you know, there's a, it's easier to build confidence, but I think, you know, major leagues, it's really effing hard, guys. I mean, it's just, it's hard. I don't care if you're the greatest prospect ever, that it takes a while to understand that experience and to be able to translate whatever your skills are at that level.
The league is littered with high, you know, big name prospects that never made it. I mean, just Brian Taylor kind of folks. It's just the way the game is.
And you look at Vlad Jr. when he was tearing it up in the minor leagues and everybody's going, why is he not playing in the majors? Clearly he's got the talent. Bring him up, bring him up. And he, you know, he, relatively speaking, he struggled. It's taken him a couple of years. And now suddenly he's one of the best players in baseball. But, you know, they stuck with him and they, you know, they did hang in there. Whereas, as you will quite rightly say, others, Acuna, Tatis, they appeared. Jazz Chisholm this season just, you know, clearly got it. Just clicked straight away. I think we've been a bit spoiled. Anyway, thanks for your input, guys. Let's move it on. Third batter up tonight. There's a very simple question. Will there be a baseball season in 2022? And the reason I ask, God. I don't know if you saw the Pete Alonso interview. I'm sure you did, Dave. these were his exact words. It's a fact that MLB changes the baseballs based on upcoming free agency classes in an attempt to manipulate salaries. That is a bit of a statement for a player to be making. Is it a sign of where the MLBPA is in relation to the upcoming CBA negotiations? Oh, yeah. I mean, what's your thoughts on this? Josh, you kick us off, first of all. Will there be a season, first of all, next season? Or do you think we are very genuinely maybe careering towards another player's strike?
Yeah, or a lockout. I think it's certainly possible. I mean, I you know, hope springs eternal. So, I'm going to hope that they get to a point. But the level of tension between the owners and the players is about as high as we've seen it in, you know, quite a long time since the last strike. And I think that you have Tony Clark, who was the head of the Players Association when I was working as an agent. He didn't have a tremendous amount of respect, to be quite honest, for his knowledge and acumen. Very smart guy. Eric and I have interviewed him before. Incredibly smart, incredibly articulate. But I wonder whether he's out of his depth on that side. And you have Rob Manfred on the other side, who is a difficult personality, too. So when you know, the people who are running, and it used to be that you'd have people at the level below that who are the voices of reason. And I wonder whether either the Players Association or Major League Baseball has those people who are in positions of power, but maybe not at the top, who can help, you know, massage this into the right place. I'm worried. I'm certainly worried, Goldie.
And let me ask you this, guys, when you think about the history of collective bargaining, it is amazing. I was looking into this, by the way. John Montgomery Ward and eight other players in 1885 formed the first players union in baseball. The Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players Protective Association was created in 1900. Fraternity of Professional Baseball Players of America in 1912. So there's a rich history. This isn't like unions have only started.
Oh, they were crushed, though. Those guys were crushed. It wasn't until Kurt Flood. It wasn't until
Marvin Miller,
who, right. I mean, you need to read his book, Goldie. It's one.
Yeah,
of the
well, Marvin books. Miller, of course, 1968, negotiated the first ever collective bargaining agreement. So, but what I'm saying is, this is a story that even if they were crushed in the early days, this process started a long time ago. We're talking, almost 135 years ago. So it's been an issue. And obviously, baseball has a rich history in terms of the strength of the players' union, the strength of feeling. And we have had lockouts by owners, 1990, 232-day strike in 94, 95. There is a history of the two sides going head-to-head and not coming to an agreement. So
The big issue to me often has been ownership, which sees players as fungible. They think that anybody who goes out, that the sport itself can carry the day and the stars aren't really important.
As evidenced by the scabs, when we had the scabs. Yeah.
And there's maybe some credence to that in baseball, right? We talk about how baseball doesn't have you know, the LeBron Jameses of the world. They never had the Michael Jordans. And it's been a long time since we saw a Mickey Mantle or a Babe Ruth of these larger than life personalities that really could carry the day, right? When you're talking about Mike Trout. And that's why there's so much effort with a player like Tatis Jr. to make them larger than life figures. But until you have a large portion of players who have that Q rating, who are that well known, ownership's going to feel comfortable to say, look, we'll just change it. They're totally wrong. I mean, baseball's on the precipice of becoming a less, I mean, it's already less relevant than it was two, three decades ago. Yeah. They need to be very careful. And I think that if there is another strike, baseball is going to become very much second tier in the United States.
They're not very careful, which is a huge problem, as evidenced by their leader, Rob Manfred, who is not very careful. So we already, that precedent is already set. With the commissioner. And if you think it was difficult for the game to come back after 94, watch what happens if they sit out a year about now, with everything going against professional sports right now when in the ratings department, with all the competition that sports faces with, you know, Netflix and streaming and everything else and TikTok. It's not, you know, they better be extremely careful. And I worry about the players union because, you know, Tony Clark, as smart as he is and as good a guy as he is, you know, I think the players really took a hit with the death of Michael Wiener, who was, you know, the highly respected leader of the Major League Baseball Players Union, which is seen by just about anybody you asked as the most, at least amongst the most powerful unions in the United States. And I think you can't underestimate the loss of his influence on the leadership of the players. And that going into a big negotiation like that, that's tough.
Dave, I think both sides realize that, but it's a game of chicken. It's both sides want to see who's going to blink first. And I worry that when you get into that vacuum of negotiation, that all of a sudden people lose sight of the broader issue. That even though they know it going in, when you get into that, you know, day after day of like hard-nosed negotiation, that both sides are going to just retrench. And if that happens, it will be, I wouldn't say
we saw it during COVID. We saw little hints of it during COVID. Sloppy, a lot of stuff coming out. You know, if I were them, I would get together and at least come together on agreement on how, trying to keep this stuff as close to the vest as possible for the good of the game. You know, this crap coming out during COVID, during a time where the planet is struggling, did no favors for the sport.
One of the problems with baseball, and this has always been the case, is that, right, ownership is incredibly wealthy. And that was a problem, you know, in the 90s, that was a problem in the 50s. But it's a bigger problem now, right? The value of these teams are so high that the owners are even more disproportionately wealthy. And when you get people of that nature, they don't know how to react to no, right?
Yeah.
They're so used to having the power that if they're being told no, they're going to say, well, screw you. I'll just take my ball and go home.
Lords of the realm.
Yeah.
Now, just of course, originally being from Montreal, nothing like in my lifetime damaged baseball more than that 1994 strike, especially when the Montreal Expos were the best team in baseball that year. Season got canceled. The very next year, the 1995 season, after everything somehow got reorganized, Montreal finished dead last. And that was just the petri dish of what a mess a lockout / strike would do to baseball.
And Montreal gets a lot of attention when it comes to teams that, you know, were victimized by the strike in 1994. But also, you know, look west. The Blue Jays had won two World Series in a row, and that team took forever to get back. They left them behind. The Blue Jays fans, they walked, and they didn't come back for a very long time. And that's talked about less. And it, you know, it kind of took them, you know, to 2013, 14, 15 before, you know, the fans really came back in droves. Of course, that comes down to winning, but also they were really disgusted by 94. Oh, in Toronto.
Attendance went way down. That's it. Moving on.
Okay, guys, thank you for that. Fascinating stuff. Let's move now into the seventh inning stretch. Rika, if we're not going to have your company for a couple of weeks or 4 or 5 weeks or so, then I'm really looking forward to your contribution. Now we're going to start with the baseball.
We get a cardboard cutout of Eric just to be in the fourth square. Can we get that possible?
You guys will be fine without me.
So what's the book of the week, big guy?
The book of the week, I figure, I'll be honest here. I haven't read it yet. Okay, because it got recommended to me. And it is about It's called The Summer of 68 by Tim Wendell. Okay. And the reason why it is recommended to me is because I'll tell you what, there was no better time to be born than the summer of 68. Well, it's on my birthday today. Don't worry. You didn't miss it. I didn't get your card yet. I know. But let's face it, the summer of 68, it was the time that the transition that changed baseball forever. It's when the pitching mound was changed. It was when we discussed the collective bargaining agreement is when the Detroit Tigers beat Bob Gibson and the St. Louis Cardinals.
And the mound changed after that season. It was the final season.
It's the final season, exactly, of the old pitcher's mound. And so it takes you through everything that changed baseball for better and worse. Of course, we had those riots in 1968. It's not just about baseball.
8 team divisions or 9, 10 team divisions.
Exactly. And it's not just about baseball. You know, that's when, you know, Robert F. Kennedy was murdered and when Martin Luther King was murdered and how baseball dealt with it. And it was a year of turmoil. So that's my book recommendation of the week, Summer of 68 by Tim Wendell, which I will read next.
Promises.
So I promise.
Just to clarify before you move on to your TV reference, on your last show for We Know Not How Long, you're recommending a book you haven't even read over one of the many books that your dear friend Josh Chestwin has written.
Sure.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify.
The baseball and pop culture. I'm going to mix in. How do you mix in the baseball, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and the New York Mets into one and make it funny? Well, I'll tell you.
It's a Zapruder film, right?
It's basically the anniversary this week. If anybody remembers this Seinfeld episode, June 14th, 1987, Mets versus Phillies.
This is the second spitter.
Yeah.
Second spitter. So basically, those who are not attuned with Seinfeld episodes, there was one episode with Keith Hernandez, as mentioned by David earlier, befriends Jerry Seinfeld. And once Kramer and Newman, two other characters in that show, find out that Jerry's befriended Keith Hernandez, they say, "You can't, he spat at us outside Shea Stadium." And the whole episode sort of intermixes how that Keith Hernandez spat on Newman and Kramer when they came out of the stadium. And then Keith Hernandez tries to say it wasn't him, and Jerry Seinfeld tries to recount the spitting incident between Keith Hernandez while sort of doing it with a Kevin Costner's JFK scene where they use the Zapruder film and likens it to the Lee Harvey Oswald assassinating JFK.
Only Seinfeld could get away with such bad taste. They made bad taste cool.
Here's the backstory of this. So, like, if those, it's on YouTube somewhere. You guys will find it. It's called, the episode's called The Boyfriend, meaning Keith Hernandez. And when Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David wrote the article, they actually had Keith Hernandez in mind for this scene. And they wrote it for Keith Hernandez, and they said, and then they approached him, and they thought, well, if he says no, we'll ask Gary Carter instead. So had Keith Hernandez said no, they wouldn't get Gary Carter. But
it wouldn't have worked with Gary Carter.
No, exactly. Keith Hernandez does work. I'm Keith Hernandez. The second spitter in the grassy knoll was Roger McDowell in the episode, but they originally wrote it for Daryl Strawberry.
Wow.
Because at the time, he was going through a lot of legal problems, which we won't go into. So they decided to use Roger McDowell instead, and so that's my pop culture, and of course Seinfeld's full of them, full of baseball. But since it's the anniversary of that spitting incident on the show, if that's this week's pop culture reference.
Little known fact: Abraham Zapruder is my mother's cousin, and his wife Lil Zapruder was a great Jewish cook, and we have her cookbook sitting in our.
What, really?
Yeah, you didn't know that about
me? That's neat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. Anybody else got a celebrity in the family?
Yeah, I got a few.
Go on then, chuck them out.
So, well, British. You know this. My aunt was Claire Rayner.
Yeah.
And my first cousin is Jay Rayner, who writes for The Guardian. He's a pretty prominent guy out there.
We did mention this back in the day. I just wonder if some of our new listeners were aware that Claire Rayner is your aunt. That's fantastic. Or was your aunt. Fantastic. Yep. Eric, anybody famous in your family?
His father
worked for KLM.
My father worked for KLM. Cool. There we go.
My mom was a regular on General Hospital too.
Because you're a beautiful mom.
I worked alongside Johnny Gould and Josh Shell and David Lingo. That's how sad it is. Yeah.
Zed level.
Yeah. Zed.
What's they haven't below, actually what's created a Zed? Level for us.
What's below Zed? Oh, Z. Z is below Zed.
Now it's time to put you out of your misery with a trivia, because with two youthful guys. I asked you earlier that since Vlad has now hit his 19th home run of the year, at the age of tender age of 22, but I asked you which of these players hit the most career home runs before the age of 22. Was it A. Rod? Was it B. Mike Trout? Or was it C. Bryce Harper? Now, who's going to go first? I will go with Josh Shetland.
I never hard, go first.
Hard. I'll go with A-Rod.
Johnny Gould?
I wanted to go with A-Rod, and now Josh has gone with it. I'm going to go with A-Rod, because if I'm wrong, then at least Josh is wrong as well.
Misery loves company, eh? Because we all know it's Bryce Harper.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. We all know that. Everybody knows that. Okay. Ask anyone.
Okay, I'll go with Trout, then. Since you're going with Harper, I'll go with Trout. So at least everybody's covered. We've got one winner and two losers. Who is it, Eric?
In no particular order, let's go with Mike Trout. He hit 98 home runs before the age of 22.
Okay.
Bryce That's Harper hit 85 home runs before the.
Oh. Yeah, Dave.
Everybody knows. Me. Everybody knows it was Mike Trout.
Thank you. Thank you.
And A-Rod hit only 106.
No, I should have stuck to my instincts. Damn.
I had a good run. I got to tell you guys, I feel like I've had.
Don't you win like every week now?
I've had a great run, and now that we're going to retire this for a little while, I'm going to just rest on my laurels.
As I said, the show shall go on, and without me, and you guys will have fun without me, and we'll have a little brief hiatus until next time. Moving on.
Well, it's abundantly clear that Eric needs to get his teeth sorted at the same time as he's working on the Olympics and Wimbledon. Right, thank you for that, big guy. Right, let's focus now on the mailbag. Many thanks for everybody getting in touch. The big responses we've had, guys, is to the question we posed about the All-Star game. Who are the obvious players? And perhaps who are the less obvious? We've had a few thrown in. Ian Blees and Andrew Savage, they've both referenced Chris Taylor with the Dodgers. So we're focusing more on the ones that perhaps aren't so abundantly obvious. I think that's a great shout. Daniel Woodrow did go down the obvious route with Vlad Jr. Dan Morrison and Jack 043510 were talking about the Astros, who have been on a bit of a run. They both went with Yuli Gurriel and Jose Altuve. So I'm going to ask you, thank you for that, guys. Just mentioned a few names there. I'm going to ask you guys now to come up with a player in team of your choice, could be your team or any team, that perhaps isn't an obvious selection, but who's had such a good season by perhaps comparative norm that they may get consideration. I'll start the ball running, guys. As a Braves fan, I would love to see Austin Riley do well in the third base selections, because he's definitely taken it up a notch or two in terms of his performances. 294 average so far, 11 home runs, 27 RBIs. Loving what he's doing for the mighty Braves. Anybody else want to make me an offer?
Yeah, I want to see Jazz Chisholm. I just want to see that guy all day. I just want to keep looking at Jazz Chisholm.
Yeah, big time.
So much fun.
I love Jazz Chisholm. I need to look a little more deeply, but I always love when middle relievers get chosen for the All-Star game. I feel like that role is so like Kitteridge with the Rays or someone like that, you know, Andrew Kitteridge. Just someone who is really not a name at all, who is performed in the role that they have in an exemplary manner and would have never been thought of as an All-Star. But
and when he comes in, everybody goes, who?
Right. But then you look at the stats and you're like, oh, right?
That's it, yeah. Well, see, I think as I'd go for Joey Votto because he's back from injury. He's finding his swing again. And, you know, I know it's about voting. It's not about performance. And he'd just be a hilarious addition to the All-Star team. And he's always good value for money on television, isn't he?
Okay, thank you, guys. We'll keep them coming, guys. We'd love to hear from you on Twitter at Johnny and Josh Show, and of course on Facebook, the Johnny and Josh Show. Do get involved, do subscribe, do point. We can do the pointy pointy with the piano, and obviously do also get involved with the other podcast in the stable that is Ted Fred. If you're into fantasy baseball, I've got the weekly output with the legend that is James Holden. Behind home plate, the Twitter handle at BHP Pod. We'd love to hear from you. You got the Nat Coombs Show at the NC Show. Do get involved with that if you're particularly into NFL. Guys, thank you so much, as always, for your time. And we look forward to seeing you back on the Johnny and Josh Show in the not too distant future. To all our listeners, thank you. Stay safe, stay well. Until next week.